We are being recorded. And it is Wednesday night. And this is life in the labyrinth, folks. We have got into the labyrinth. We haven't been able to find our way out. But that's another story. We're kind of stuck there. Life in the Labyrinth by E.J. Gold. We've been working our way through this after before it, as a basis for it, we have worked our way through the human biological machine as a transformational apparatus by E.J. Gold, practical work on self, joy of sacrifice. This was the next book. This is the next one. So we've spent a lot of time studying how the human biological machine operates in this cosmos that we have found ourselves, because do note, for whatever reason, we have found ourselves here. And if you note the fact that whatever your theories or postulations may be, at the moment, you have manifested here. You're not manifest in another dimension. Right now, at this moment, we are manifest here together. That's the point of departure for which we will we will move forward. And we are starting, we have been already through 10 chapters, and we are starting tonight on chapter 11. Chapter 11 is called Shape Shifting Up the Totem. I don't have an illusion that we'll get all the way through the chapter, though we'll see. And this is very, very, very meaty stuff. There's a lot here. So it's worth it to take the time. The technique we're using is a technique I call slow reading. And by slow reading, all I mean is we're penetrating what's here. In a sense, the words are secondary to the effort we're making. The words are a signpost, and we're using the signpost as an indication of where to apply our attention. All right? That's why we're using this particular book at this particular moment, because it is providing us with a signpost. If you read this chapter 11, you'll understand that is the beginning of what we're calling moving and shape-shifting up the totem. What are the tools that we're gathering to do the work and the investigation that we have before us? I strongly urge you to go on to the website, wingsofchaos.com/Life in the Labyrinth, Chapter 11. Read the introductory text that I put in there, and there's a very interesting post which I'm going to read a little bit later for those who have not had a chance to go on. But in any event, with all that hoopla, all of that introduction, so what? Let us launch our sailing craft away from the shore, and we're going to do it together. We're going to do it right now. And MA, would you like to get us started?
On chapter 11, shape shifting up the totem. I'm using the old edition, Life in the Labyrinth, and it's on page 105.
And that's 119 in the newer edition right here.
Okay. So I'm reading the little introduction here. Voyaging back and forth between the human and other dimensions, using powerful mental and emotional equations to produce a tangible construct, a totemic ladder, a dimensional elevator, the voyager shapeshifts through the totemic morphologies, up, down, or both at once.
So, two things may occur when you read such a thing. One, you may read it and you go, wow, that's really complicated. I don't understand it. Or you can be frightened out of your bejesus because this is an actual formulaic and very clear statement of what this chapter offers. The secret keeps itself, and the way the secret keeps itself is because we don't put in the effort. If we don't put in the effort to penetrate and open a door, it'll always remain there. But you place the effort into it and you get something back. That's what this chapter is talking about, creating these constructs that are possible to work with. They are viable tools for voyaging. But I warn you, let us read the first sentence, and that makes it even more difficult. That we may perform our obligation task. That's all in big letters. That we may. This is the context. In the macro dimensions, our obligation tasks in the macro dimensions. Place yourself just for a moment in that macro dimension and vision it in a sense. Vision it. And do you have a obligation task? You may or may not know what it is at the moment, but guess what? You might sense that it is there even. And the sensing that it is there, that is there, is something that can feed its formulation. It's something that can, is part of a mental and emotional equation to produce a tangible construct. So you want to know how to do it? Place yourself in the concept called, in the space called, obligation tasks in the macro dimension. We must learn to move freely in the unobstructed pathways through space. This freedom of movement depends almost wholly upon one's use of a combination of whole body and the mask for further definition. The mask is a simple name for complex network construct of identity, posture, form, sound, scent, and all of the elements which constitute a living morphological boundary scent. Okay, what do all those things mean? First of all, they will have a signature for each one of us. For some, it may be a particular scent. For me, I use a scent, and Molly knows this, called Frankincense Classic. This is, for me, it's a very potent one. It's far from sweet. It's on the opposite tonal scent scale. And it is, for me, it takes a serious tone. It's the tone called prayer. And that's just an element that I place on my table, in a sense, to begin the process that we are now talking about. Okay? We're talking about creating a totemic structure upon which we can rely. Okay? Now, that totemic structure has nothing to do with the animals carved in a piece of wood that goes straight up and down, actually. But those are reminding factors, and the reminding factors do come into play for those that have eyes. And how do we find those eyes? Oh, I see. It says right here, you place yourself in the obligation in the space called obligation tasks in the macro dimension. That doesn't mean how does Joe or Mary get better and a better shaman so that their big egos can go ahead. No. It means how can I do that which I am called forth to do? Okay? The mystery of the mask. The mask, a thin layer of self-reality held in place by the hand as a Lanmei, I think it's pronounced.
Okay.
And that's, those are opera, like opera glasses, like colored opera glasses or something.
Okay.
Worn across the face, produced by grimace, supported and uplifted by vocal distortion. So we carry this mask right here, and that mask, we think as long as we use that mask, we will then be forced into our own chambers. We don't have the ability of resilience, the resilience of motion. And jumping ahead, mystery of masks. No mystery. The shaman uses the mask in much the same way that Londoners might take the underground. So once again, he's referring to a method of voyaging. The Londoner calls it a underground. The shaman calls it a mask.
I think it's interesting that all his analogies of who uses this, except for the Catholic priest, which is using the breviary there. But they're all using some sort of underground transportation tube. And I found that interesting,
yeah.
that was the analogy in order to use these masks. It's that we can voyage from place to place using the mask, but it's analogous to a tube that takes you from place to place to place and runs on a particular track.
And it does. And I think that Piangio might, I'm not sure if he's on or not, but we spoke about the Tree of Life a few weeks ago. Were you here for that one?
I don't think I was. No.
We were here.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about Ein Sof, Kether, and moving down the Tree of Life. Well, in that Tree of Life, those Sephiroth are connected by specific paths. It's not arbitrary paths.
Mm-hmm.
They're very specific.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get there just kind of wandering into it. You move through a specific mannerism. Now, there's a lot of very sophisticated voyaging techniques that's discussed in this chapter. What I want to do is, how can we interpret that for the beginning voyagers that we are? So what can we do? How can I interpret that? What tools do you use? What shamanic mask do you put on? A shaman may have 1,000 or 10,000 masks, but because he grasps the foundation of that, the principles by which many more may be constructed, he may find and use anything at hand, like a magic coin, where suddenly the brain, the linear brain, is suspended. It's choked off because it's suddenly in wonder, and it says, how can that be that you've turned water into wine? Well, we must be somewhere else then. Costume, music, lighting, also sounds in the environment, also a particular form of movement. And then jumping ahead a few paragraphs at the very end of page 120, all these taken together form the invocational trinity. Do you see that?
Yeah, that's on 106.
106.
Mm-hmm.
All these taken together form the invocational trinity, which translated to common English would give us the concept of set, setting, and dosage. I'd like to pause there for a moment and just see, what does that mean to you? You know, we're talking here about the idea of this is invocation. This is called labyrinth voyaging. What does it mean to you? Set, setting, dosage. And Molly, if anybody says anything. Are we going too fast here?
No,
Is this okay? Keep talking? Okay. Go ahead. Mark Rose says set.
I'd like to respond to that.
Okay, good, please do.
From a theater terminology, I'd like to respond to the set and the setting and the dosage in terms of theater.
Perfect.
So the set is the environment. Just the chairs. Our set is our chairs and our microphones and our camera and our telephone.
Our background.
Our background. This is our set. Now our setting is that we're given the task to work on life in the labyrinth. So
correct.
That's what we're doing in our set, is we're performing our setting.
Act 11.
And our dosage, I look at dosage as intensity.
Yeah.
How much of intensity are we going to be giving during this performance that we had, this task that we've been assigned, which is our setting, on our set?
And let me define dosage and intensity a little bit more by something that Molly said about 4 weeks ago, when Lost Horizon was actually physically here, and you were on the show, there were four of us. Do you remember what you said? Does Lost Horizon remember what Molly said that night? No? No? There's more attention in each moment. More attention, and it appears that it's accelerating, but there's more attention. And how do we put more attention in it each moment? One is we give up the human mask, and as you start to allow that to drift away, there's more attention available. And since you have the advantage of set setting, now you have a place for the dosage in which it can occur.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you dropped away.
We've got the place. We've got our reason.
Our
reason. Our task.
Yeah.
And now we have our.
We now may place our attention.
Our attention.
On it. And now, as with a fire. Oh wait. What are the elements of a fire again? I can't remember.
Air.
Air.
Fuel.
Fuel. Oh. And. Heat.
Oh, yeah. I guess we need heat, too, huh?
So when there's a triad like that, there's a chance for a fire to occur. We won't get Silverdale started on the triad that I know he's itching to tell us about, and he's taught us so many times about the ultimate triad that we're aiming for. Am I right, Silverdale, or close to it?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So here it is. Now, on our own personal scale, what we want to do is we say, oh, wait a minute, I'm not really a shaman. I can't do this. I'll go see someone who's a shaman, because then they'll do it. And gradually, I have the opportunity to give my power away to that person. And then I can say, oh, yeah, it was really magical what that person did. When at the same time, you can get together, what does it say? I don't know if anybody reads the Bible much, but it says, like, when two or more are gathered in my name, I am there also. So that you have the Christ consciousness is possible if in my name is occurring in the work that you're doing. So that. Setting, dosage, so you place that in the room, you set that.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a vehicular construct to get you where you need to go. All we need to worry about at this level, because we're beginners, we just need to worry about the idea of what are the two attributes that the essential self has again? Does anybody remember?
Presence and attention.
Oh, presence and attention.
Yay, somebody came out with
that. That's all we have to use, nothing more.
Supplemented by adoration.
It's complemented, it's fueled, it's passion. Adoration. That's the tool that we picked up when we were doing HVM, and now we understand, now we have it in our tool bag to use. So if we can get to presence and attention, fueled by adoration, then we can begin to build our own totemic construct, our own elevator, as Silverdale told us a few weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
this elevator.
Hey, David.
Yo.
There's a question Mark Roach is asking. He's still not clear about setting.
Okay. So here's how I view it, and I think MA gave us a great definition. So the set is my is where I am right now. We have constructed the set. For me, I don't know if anybody was here when I walked in, but the first thing is I did is I placed my tee down directly behind the phone. I placed my book underneath, and then I proceeded to do a few things to complete the set. The setting was, oh, I am here.
Why did we construct the set?
Why are we here to construct the set? What did we do to construct the set? Tonight we did it because it's called Chapter 11. So we did it to begin the process of Chapter 11. Chapter 11, in a sense, is a myth because though it is the guide for us, what is actually happening right now is what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
This is just the help to remind us of this place. Oh.
It made us sit down in our set.
In our set to perform, in a sense, the setting. Mark, does that help at all? Did he answer?
No, that was Susan. I was just reading the log.
Yeah, I know, Susan. I was just wondering if that helped you and or Mark. Did that help us a little bit?
Did Mark reply?
He said it helped a little bit, but he'll have to contemplate on it.
Okay.
Pianjo said that the setting means to me to pick the right moment, the best time to introduce something new to create a new effect.
Okay. That's okay, too. That could be... Setting has a lot to do with intention. These spaces actually mean something. This is not entertainment. I did not come here tonight for entertainment purposes. I came here tonight with a great burden on my shoulder, which when I walked through the door, I did not believe I was the right person to carry that burden. But the burden was upon me anyway, and I did carry it through. And here I am with it on me. That's what I came to do. I don't know what I'm going to find out. I didn't know what I'd find out as we walked through these minutes together. But I did know I could get here. I did know I could get here, and I knew the set would be placed,
mm-hmm.
and I could begin the process called, and it has a title to it. It's called Chapter 11. Now, your intention, Tianjo, might be, oh, I want to find something new. That's a generality. When you say the word something new, if you understand your set, you'll know what the setting called find something new is. For instance, if you're working with your group, there might be something like, oh, somehow they are blocked in the manner in which they operate, and we're going to move them in a new way. That would be a worthy task. So the intention comes from, the intention is what, in a sense, colors the setting or brings forth the task. The beginning of the chapter is called Obligation Tasks in the Macro Dimension. Does that help a teeny bit, Susan?
Yes, it does for me.
Okay, because I don't take this lightly. When I sit down here, it's like I sit down and I'm kind of like I'm strapped into the chair. I'd have a very hard time getting. I don't think I could get up, actually. Oddly enough.
Really?
Because of the obligation task in the macro dimension. Oh. We're meant to do something here together tonight.
Exactly.
And we are doing it together.
Yeah.
And every single element of is here.
Right.
Who's,
to the, right
how
to the
how many people are here right now? 16, 18? 15 or 16 people. Plus us here, there's like almost 20 people. This, we were meant to come together tonight and do something. We may not have all of the skills required to know what it is we are doing or what we may have accomplished. But for me, we're making a move on a chessboard, and the chessboard is called Powers and Principalities. And we are making that move. For the good guys. Okay.
All together.
Do you want these last couple comments?
Please, go ahead.
Simon says, I think, Jim, that intention is included in the setting, but it's not the same. And then Pianjo says, I tend to think of setting as mindset, setting as picking the right time and place, and dosage as balancing intention and intensity. Thanks for this clarification, David.
Good.
And then Hawk Lady's asking, can you speak about the intensity of the burning?
Yes. As we move further up the totemic scale, they'll feel this burning more because we're further and further away from the egocentric regular life that we lead. We're leaving that environment and we're moving into more non-worldliness. And it's at that moment, Hawk Lady, that we have the opportunity to practice surrender. If you feel you're in the right direction, which will take experimentation, but if you are, then let that cleansing radiation come through.
I was going to say that there's always a shedding when you're moving from a gross dimension to a finer dimension. There's got to be a shedding because you're shedding off the gross part, but that is what you're just saying to Hawk Lady.
Yeah.
Yeah. That that we're moving into finer and finer dimensions just by reading about the dimensions. We're moving into those finer dimensions. So we're refining and shedding off grosser manifestations and moving into finer movements.
And that feels like a burning.
Right, that can feel like a burning because it's coming off, and it's something that we've had on for so long we didn't even know that we were wearing it. But when it starts to come off, it can feel like relief, burning. I mean, there's a lot of sensations that it can bring up, but the fact that we're doing it together brings a refining way to go towards it. We're not doing it in a way of ripping off. We're doing it in a way of moving through that in a gentle space.
In a gentle space. Mm-hmm. I recall many, many years ago an event that was extremely tense for me. And there was I was literally on all fours sobbing you know, kind full
of,
body.
Kind of doing the Carlos Castaneda thing.
Full body sobbing. And then I'd go into a form of laughter and back into it, out of it, into it, out of it. And it was like this, but it was this space that allowed the opportunity. And then I took the advantage of that and attempted to do what I could, which, who knows, it was very, very much, but I just did what I could.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you recognized that you were in another space.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is, you
and
know.
And you were shedding all these things as you were going
I did
from,
shed.
From state to state to state, state.
I did.
Back and forth like that. That's one way of getting rid of things really fast.
not pleasant necessarily.
Yeah. This is a little
well, more. And Hawk Lady said sometimes to the point of no air in her lungs.
Yeah.
So that's similar.
So what you can do, Hawk Lady, and others that I've talked to recently about these things, when you can't get to a point where it appears that you can't breathe, you flip back and forth between a space called I am, which is, the space called I am is equal to presence and attention. Okay, it's just another word for it. I am that I am. Okay, presence and attention. You flip into that space to mark it, in a sense, but then you come back to slow down, and you slow down, and then you just focus on the next breath. We're not skilled enough to do much else then. All we're able to do is to hang out there. If we can hang out there, that's what we can do right now.
Mm-hmm. And that could be for nanoseconds at a time.
Whatever you're, so you then you begin to see when you're hanging out there. Oh, yo, I'm hanging out really good. Well, you're gonna break if you do that.
Yeah.
So the only if you tense up magnificently, you will break. The power play in that space is a power play called acquiescence or surrender. Believe me, you're not bigger than it. But you can do something.
So it seems there's a lot of talk on the Norton Street videos and talk about how the 30 short videos you can watch. It's like there's a bit of talk on that.
I missed what you said.
Yeah, you cut out there, Susan.
Oh, I was just saying there's a lot of comments on the videos from Norton Street.
Oh,
on the log right now, you mean?
Yes.
Okay. So, read a couple of those comments so I can orient a little bit.
Okay. It said, what MA just said is, I think, why watching the Norton Street videos is so powerful. Mark Roach is saying, a series of 30 short Machinima videos EJ made, and
yeah,
that they're available on YouTube.
Okay, so that's an element that Mark brings to the table when he is constructing his voyaging space. He watches that, and for him, that's a method that he uses.
Mm-hmm. Right. Within it, the more you watch, the higher law conforming you become. If I remember it right, it is designed to activate the waking state within us.
Correct. And part of the reason is that it's non-linear. The linear brain kind of can't hook onto it in any way.
Mm-hmm.
There's no hook from the linear brain, so something else starts to operate. And we feel a sense of home, and we start to move into that. Very good example.
So that's it on the log.
Okay, good. I'm going to read two quick paragraphs. This is going to be very slow. As experienced macro-dimensional day commuters, we are quite aware that in order to voyage from one point to another, we must inevitably pass through several stations, each mask a station of the way. Okay? Does this click for anybody? Okay. Sorry. To extemporaneously voyage and navigate without the convenience of props and costumes whenever the need arises, makeshift and improvisation are the voyager's stock in trade. Basically, what that means, the voyager is able to pull from whatever space they're in to create the set and help enhance the setting, and they bring the dosage to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The instinct for navigation is omnipresent. Do you believe that? Molly says yes. MA is nodding her head yes. The instinct for navigation is omnipresent.
I think we all want to navigate somewhere.
To the macro mind that made the labyrinth, the apprehension of the chaotic form is as natural as our instant appreciation of a symphony, but only as a totality to the shaman. Chaos, the spectrum of reality outside the realm of imposed order, is as readable as a map, road map. Nice.
Mm-hmm.
And that sentiment is why I got the website years ago called Wings of Chaos, and the header is Learning to Ride the Wings of Chaos. Okay. Jumping ahead, the lightning path is that which thrusts us into the work the quickest, not that which serves our subjective aims. We can use our voyaging to escape the confining gravitational attraction of biological mediocrity. What? .com. Shamanism is the fastest, most ego-disintegrating and emotionally explosive all the ways. It brings us directly and wholly into the work, now and forever, long before we feel really ready to tackle the job. Can someone interpret that for me? Is there anybody online to interpreting that phrase?
Can you tell me what page we are?
On the new version, it's 121.
On the old version, it's 107.
Thank you.
Shamanism is the fastest, most ego-disintegrating, emotionally explosive all the ways. And it brings us directly and wholly into the work, now and forever, long before we feel ready to tackle the job. Did anybody help me out there, Molly? That's exactly right, Mark. And if, in fact, though nobody answered the question, that it's the instinct is omnipresent, if you allow yourself to be tossed into the water, into the pool, you might react by the growth into the right and proper space. There are people that I can point to right now, which I won't specifically, who are superb at that. They come alive when that space is present. They become alive when that space is working. Okay? So where are we?
Well, I think that if, you know, shamanism is to be able to shapeshift to be able to take on a different mask, then it would blow your ego away.
Yes.
Right away.
If you actually allow that to occur, because then you are being of ultimate service, you're not, you know, just being yourself more. You're being other than self more. And you're exactly right, Susan. That's exactly right.
I think you'd have to work on the ego bit a bit before you really tried the shamanism part.
Well,
I don't think that you should test out that right at the beginning, whether you want to go in there for ego enhancement or should you do it for shamanism.
Well, but if you're actually becoming other, then your ego just goes. It's not really a choice.
Right.
Yeah.
You're compelled.
Yeah. But if you weren't expecting that, then you could get quite a shock. So I think you'd have to maybe work on being in that space a little bit, as we've been. As we do.
Okay. Now I'm on a paragraph on page 122 in the new version. Shamanism is a business in the same sense that any other form of work is a business. Do you see that?
Yeah, it's on 108.
And just like any other business, is forced to operate on a profit margin, which in turn depends upon cost efficiency. You don't just do this because it's cool to do. Voyaging through the labyrinth has its own price to pay, nothing more. Certainly, than the hungriest and most extravagant designer label buyer. You know the kind. When then any shaman worth his weight in metallic salts will, if he values his work, ascertain that the results of labyrinthine voyages are worth the inevitable heavy extortion, or he or she won't be able to repeat the experiment for very long. And we're talking about, of course, that the HBM gets, in a sense, sacrificed on that throne of voyaging. It is expensive. But the implication from these writers, certainly from what E.J. Gold is saying right now, is it is worth it. For me, it is worth it. I maintain that it is worth it. The shaman is therefore forced to use the most ruthlessly efficient means to accomplish shamanistic purposes, as long as it doesn't cause harm, and quickly learns that personal profit cannot be taken from the general fund. What do you think that means?
Well, the general fund is a really interesting way of saying this, you know, because I've never seen any other writer equate any esoteric practice with cost efficiency. So this is it's a connect that I hadn't looked at before, but I think it's easy to understand.
M.A. is sweet. Did anybody have an answer on what it means?
Yeah.
Okay. So we can't take what we are, if we are going to wind up using what we find in the in those spaces and bring it back to the ego, it won't last forever. We won't be able to do this forever. Something will be diminished if that's the case. And didn't we learn something about data retrieval in the higher dimensions before? That was last chapter. Above all, the experienced shaman is aware of the terrible cost of recreational voyaging. And jumping ahead, we always have the option of not entering the maze and not performing the work. No shame in letting the cup pass. In any case, we have no guarantee that we'll actually be able to perform the work, even if we wish to and find ourselves in a position to. Boy, pity us that are here this evening, because once you have taken up the cup and you've taken up that obligation, it's hard to put it down, because as Hawk Lady is saying, it burns, but it is such a sweet sensation too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worth doing. It's worth doing to let that, I call it grace for the moment, to let that flow through and to be a magnet for that. And it'll burn you up a bit too. Then jumping to the end of that page, a shaman will never forget the higher purposes of the essential self in spite of the pressures of the biological machine, which, like all other biological machines, could not in all fairness be said to share exactly in the voyager's enthusiasm for the work, of course, although it would have served us well if only it brings the essential self into a position of transformation. And that's where we have found ourselves, and that's what I was saying at the beginning. We have found ourselves here tonight, haven't we?
Yeah.
So our biological machines brought us here. That's the gift that it gave, in a sense. It at least brought us to the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And once in the temple, maybe we can do something together, and we are doing something together. And we note that this evening, that we are doing that together.
I like that sentence. It will have served us well if only it brings the essential self into a position of transformation and evolution.
And that, like I said, at least I knew I could get to the chair. At least you knew you could get to the computer tonight. Or at least you knew you could get on the phone tonight. That at least you could do. And here you are. And here we are. And we notice certain things very about this space. Jumping ahead, totemism is founded on the basic understanding that all identities, both manifest and unmanifest, can be understood as totemic forms. Isolated and distinct morphological configurations, which are, through expansion, transcendable, existing simultaneously and corresponding in many dimensions at once. The unique cross-dimensional point-to-point similarity providing the potential for assumption by total but temporary identity. So we can note these moments, these little these points of similarity. And this is why, as we have spend more time doing this, and Hawk Lady, who's spoken, you spend time there, you need to not just remember your sensations, but look around a little bit. What do you notice? You're going to notice little things that you can hook onto to help move you ahead. And you can become the rubber band lady and use the rubber band that you find to pull you into that space. And these are the corresponding morphological configurations. Okay, there are, you can sense the morphology of a particular space. And that's the space in which you're to work at that moment. And this is where we are right now. This is where I happen to be. And I look around, and here's what I see.
I was thinking that it may be more than just the space as I'm reading this. The totemic side of it. It's more like if I was going to shapeshift, say, Star Trek, Deep Space Nine, you know, there's a shapeshifter on there.
Okay.
Anyway, he shapeshifts into a human form, a morphological construct. And then he goes back into his bucket, you know, and he kind of, that's where he sleeps in his bucket. But, you know, he can come into a human form or he can come into an animal form, supposedly, or any form that has a morphological construct. So I was thinking that it's more than just a space that we could be talking about as shapeshifters. We're talking about actually going into another morphological construct.
It is a morphological. I thoroughly agree with you on that, that we actually change shape. But what we're changing shape is our electrical body, and we are able to morph into different spaces, into different shapes, literal shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's why you have all this thing about the animistic shape that people take on, like of the cougar or the
bird,
badger or the bear, whatever it is.
An owl.
The owl. They take on different shapes because that's the morphology that particular Voyager takes on. Before we get to the end of the class, which we haven't made that much progress on the chapter, I don't think, but I did want to read what was posted on the website.
Oh,
and we'll have, pardon?
That was beautiful. I'm glad you're reading it.
Yeah. I want to read it for the recording. And this was posted very early in the morning by Aria. I experimented this week. I found that mostly I feel as if I dance. I found that mostly I feel as if I dance. There is a sense of grace and surrender to the space. I find I am more willing now than ever I was before to become something other than myself. No matter what I become, I still dance through it. I lead with my heart. If my mind gets involved, I'm back in ego. And it's got to be all heart. In some spaces, I'm a dance of light. In others, a dancing, vibrational beam of energy. And in some, a body, mine or not mine. Doesn't seem to matter. Holding on to presence at times when confronted still is a challenge. Sensing the space, the right shape, none of it matters if I'm in ego. I'm lost, spiraling down toward to earth, and also none of it matters when I'm not in ego either. When it's all the essential self, just being what needs to be being. And, of course, all is lost. I am not willing to go. I finally learned, understood on a different level, after all this time, what is meant, that the mind does not need to understand, cannot understand, or comprehend what the essential self does, and that truly it is a matter of willingness. Willingness to go, willingness to be, to voyage, to be in presence, to shift, to morph, the willingness to get out of my own way that makes it possible.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
That is
gorgeous. It really is such a fine piece that she wrote. Thank you, Maria.
When I'm not an ego either, then it's all the essential self just being what needs to be being. And that reminds me of some of the things that Silverdale has said that when we're in that essential self, we're connected to all of it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sense of that full connectivity.
Wow.
She has a way of experiencing that through dance, which is just marvelous that she's able to have that way of working.
And she has paid quite a price to get to that level of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
That was expensive. But she might say, and I don't know if she's, I think she's on, right? She might say, and it was worth it. Or not, I don't know. But
well, she certainly opened up a whole branch of work for herself.
And she made it here tonight,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's all she could do. Her
mm-hmm.
biological machine was able to bring her to this moment. Brought her to the moment when she could write what she did from the wars that she has fought. And I don't want to say that there was a victory there, but there was a breakthrough that she was clearly able to see. And then she expressed it and shared it with the rest of us. Thank you.
That was cool.
That was cool. So, we're oddly enough, we've gone through a whole hour.
Wow.
That was a quick hour.
Like you said, it's a meaty chapter.
It's a very meaty chapter, and I know I'm skipping over a lot, but, we're going to have to take another week on this particular chapter, and Emma, I'm hoping that you have some time to help us through the next half of the chapter.
I will do that.
In the next half of the chapter, we're going to get into some of the things that some of the books that are written on shape-shifting, like the Papyrus of Ani, and the hints that those particular voyagers try to give us back, and see where we go. So, is there anything else, Molly, that we need to address right away, or how you doing over there, Susan?
Oh, I'm doing good.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah, it seems like everyone's just kind of saying good nights and stuff like that on the log.
Yes.
And everyone is thanking Aura for her sharing.
Yeah. And I noticed so clearly how dynamic you were this evening as well. So thank you for that.
Well, sure. And I guess I'm willing to offer myself up as a liaison with the log.
That would be wonderful, and I appreciate that. That's very, very, very helpful.
Yeah, I kind of was putting it off because it makes me have to pay more attention, but I'm up for it.
Oh, shucks. Darn it. Well, let's just say it's worth the shot, okay?
All right, let's do it.
Thank you for that effort. And thank everybody for this evening, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week. However, the following week, which is the 20th of June, we will not have a class. Next week, yes. The following week, no.
We do have one more question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Aura is asking, do you recommend a particular translation of the Papyrus of Ani?
Well, I'll just speak really briefly to that. This was something, if you read it, it was first translated by Wallace Budge, and his particular biography is remarkable. Once again, it was somebody that was not classically trained, and he became one of the giants of Egyptology in England during his lifetime. He was the first one to really bring it forth. And there's not really any one particular Egyptian Book of the Dead. There were many Books of the Dead. Unfortunately, I don't have a name that I could say, but I do know that the translations have gotten better over the years. So as we look at those, maybe we can help each other out and come up with one that would help all of us. So I just wanted to give that little teeny background on it.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, no, Ari, I don't have a recommendation at the moment. Okay?
She can help us come to one.
She can certainly help us come to one. So thank you all.
Thank you, David. Thank you, everyone.
See you next week. Good night.